dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Everyone seems to be feeling a rising sense of alarm as the prices of food and energy skyrocket and the number of people losing their livelihood grows. This is made worse by the political leaders and corporate media's failure to tell the truth or the whole truth about what's on the horizon, or to offer any solution but a modified version of business as usual. This week, we'll hear from three people who will address what's happening and why, and discuss predictions and strategies for the future. One is an American economist, one a Russian emigre who lived through the chaos in the collapsing Soviet Union, and another an Indian activist fighting for an open-source food system. We'll begin with the economist. He's Dr. Michael Hudson, and he recently spoke with Bonnie Faulkner, whose excellent program Guns and Butter airs on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. Here's Bonnie Faulkner.
Dr. Hudson is a financial economist and historian. He is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trend, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His 1972 book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, is a critique of how the United States exploited foreign economies through the IMF and World Bank. He is also author of The Myth of Aid and Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order. On today's program, we discuss his newest book in progress, The Fictitious Economy, How Finance is Destroying Industrial Capitalism and Paving a New Road to Serfdom. We examine what is meant by the term fictitious, as the concept is applied to aspects of today's economy, including real estate and housing, corporate junk bonds, pension plans, costs, capital, statistics, theories, and ideologies. We take a look at the role of war and the demise of the dollar, the bubble economy, and what could unfold in the future. Dr. Michael Hudson, welcome.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Your new book, The Fictitious Economy, How Finance is Destroying Industrial Capitalism and Paving a New Road to Serfdom, details many fictitious aspects of the economy today. Fictitious incomes, costs, capital, savings, statistics, theories, and ideologies. What do you mean by fictitious?
Something that's unreal, something just pretend. For instance, pretended earnings of companies that really aren't earned, or pretended values for mortgages that were given by Wall Street banks and their affiliates when there's no underlying value there. Or fictitious costs. Most economic theory today justifies fictitious costs. For instance, the Federal Reserve has a method of assessing land values that almost seems negative in some years because it treats real estate as having buildings that steadily rise in value as their reproduction costs grow, leaving land as a residual, which understates the real value of land and overstates the value of buildings. The tax code is fictitious because real estate owners have been permitted for the last half century to pretend that the buildings are losing value very rapidly, and so they can take off enough for building depreciation so that they don't have to pay any income tax at all, as it works out. The fact is buildings don't lose value. They're maintained with normal maintenance and repairs, and if landlords don't do this, then either they're brought to court for violating the residential building laws, or they break the commercial lease. So right down to the seemingly empirical statistics and theory, the whole economy is based on a kind of parallel universe world, a what-if world of assumptions that is designed to show that the wealthy people don't have any income at all. In fact, if you're wealthy in today's economy, you don't make any money because it's all a cost. Corporations don't seem to make money because they seem to have everything as an expense. For instance, interest payments are the largest item that the Internal Revenue Service permits corporations to take off as an expense of doing business. And it's not an expense of doing business at all. It's what outside buyers and corporate raiders have paid their junk bondholders in order to buy out the company. And instead of doing business, they're carving it up, closing it down, downsizing, cutting off long-term research and development and other projects, and are doing just the opposite of what is needed for an industrial economy. And that's why the book deals primarily with how the financial sector is not part of the economy at all, nor is the property sector part of the economy. It's completely separate from the production and consumption process. It's more in the character of a parasite than actual producer of goods and services. Now, I should say that I'm in the process of writing the book. It's not going to be out for another year. I only sent you an indication of what I'm writing now. So what we're talking about is not a book that people can go out and buy. It's a work in progress, and I'm presenting part of it at a meeting at the University of Kansas City next weekend where I teach their annual post-Keynesian heterodox economic meeting.
Well, to follow up on what you've just said, Dr. Hudson, in your book that you're working on, you say the economy today is really two economies, a productive industrial one that produces the needs of society and a financial superstructure, sometimes called the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, that is siphoning income away from workers and industrial capital and working to their detriment by loading them down with ever-increasing debt. Could you explain this a little further?
Well, the national income and product accounts treat everyone who earns an income is producing a service. So if you're taking money out of an ATM machine and I hold a gun and say your money or your life, I'm giving you the service of your life and you're giving me the money you've taken out. This is the opposite of what classical economics is all about. About a century ago, when the classical economists, Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, and the reform era tried to say, look, there's some income that is not earned. Rent is not earned. It's an excess price. Interest is not earned. It's a monopoly price. Monopoly profits aren't earned. They're extortionate. All this was viewed as something that government regulators should get rid of, either by not permitting it in price, or the monopolies would be held in the public domain, or the land itself would be either nationalized or taxed. The classical economists divided almost the entire economy into productive versus unproductive labor, into wealth and overhead, into real income and costs. This threatened the vested interests with taxing away their free lunch. And so you have an anti-classical reaction that is epitomized by the Chicago school of right-wing anti-government, anti-tax people, whose leader, Milton Friedman, said there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, classical economics was all about the free lunch. That's Ricardian rent theory. That's the whole theory of economic rent. And the role of modern economic theory, or I should call it postmodern economic theory and statistics, is to pretend that the banks and the landlords and monopolies actually earn their money instead of extracting it from the economy.
Now, your book is really an anecdote to the dominant Chicago school of free marketeers. What is the meaning of free market today, as understood on Wall Street, where
it's,
the Chicago
It's exactly the opposite of what Adam Smith and Ricardo and the classical economists defined as a free market. Classical economics defined a free market as a market free of overhead charges, free of unnecessary charges of production, free of watered stock. Today, a free market means that predators are free to extort any price they want from the public. They are free to deregulate, free to lie to consumers, free to exploit, free to load any company that they want down with debt, and basically lead to a world of debt peonage. So that what they call the road to serfdom of government is actually the road to debt peonage that they're leading down. So the whole concept of freedom has been turned upside down by the Chicago School and by the Bush administration.
Well, why is today's understanding so different?
Because hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent to mislead people and to endow business schools and universities to stop teaching the history of economic thought, to stop teaching the classical economists, and essentially to brainwash students so that students who have a sense of realism simply drop out of the field of economics and go into some other field.
You identify a huge generalized bubble economy that has developed through massive debt increases in several areas. Could you go into how the bubble is being inflated in some major areas of the economy?
All bubbles are inflated by credit. And the Federal Reserve, under Alan Greenspan, created a huge amount of credit that would be lent out to almost anybody for any purpose. So the, a bubble economy is when banks and other creditors will lend to borrowers with no visible means of repaying the loan. In fact, a bubble economy occurs when banks will make loans to cover the interest charge. They'll make loans for properties that don't earn enough to pay the interest, that don't earn enough to amortize the debt, but can only pay the banks by borrowing the money, adding the new loan onto the existing balance, and essentially let the loan grow exponentially by compound interest. And that's impossible to maintain over time because no economy can grow exponentially over time, and so the bubble bursts.
Now, could you talk about corporate junk bonds as part of this bubble? And also, could you talk a little bit about the elimination of defined benefit pension plans?
Okay, they're two separate topics, but they are related. Junk bonds came in after 1980. Around 1980, the Carter and Volcker inflation had pushed interest rates up to 20%. There were a lot of books at that time in the late 70s talking about how this spelled doom for the economy because they couldn't see how the economy could run up any more debt than it was. But lo and behold, here came Drexel Burnham and its legal firm, Skadden Arps, and they essentially declared they were a group of essentially gangsters. And they said, we have a way of getting back at, of just taking over companies. We're going to borrow the money, buy out the stockholders, and instead of companies paying dividends on their stock as in the past, which they have to pay after they pay taxes, they can pay twice as much in interest. In 1980, the tax rate was 50%. So if you had a company earning $2 million a year, say, it could pay $1 million in taxes and $1 million in dividends. But once the junk bond people took it over, the company could now pay $2 million in interest, so it could pay twice as much to the debt holders. The banks had lobbied the government to permit interest to be charged as a tax-deductible expense, so essentially the taxpayers were subsidizing the takeover of industry at very high interest charges, so high that companies had to cut back their investment, cut back their employment and downsize in order to pay the people who'd taken over. There were a lot of lawsuits about this, but the courts declared that all of this was basically legal. Now, the companies were in such financial stress, having to pay the bondholders so much money, that they then were facing bankruptcy. So they went to the workers, as General Motors did a year ago, and one company after another has gone to their labor force and said, look, we're going to go bankrupt. And if we go bankrupt, we're going to wipe out your whole pension fund, because the law says you're at the end of the line. The basic rule of American law is the rich get paid first, the normal people get paid last. The richer you are, you're at the head of the line. The poorer you are, you're at the back of the line. So the corporation said, we owe so much money to our bondholders and to the bankers that have lent us the money that there's not enough money to pay them and to pay you workers. So the labor union said, well, wait a minute. We agreed to lower current wages in order for you to pay us pensions later. And the bosses said, well, we don't care about that. The law's on our side. We've bought the courts. We've bought Congress. Our lobbyists give congressmen and the lawmakers a lot more money than you do, so you lose. And so the result of the junk bond process is to load American industry so much down with debt that there's no money to pay pension. So instead of paying a defined pension as people had expected, they've gone to what they call a defined payment program. Now, the word defined remains the same to make people think it's not a change, but the reality is pension plans are like the Roach Motel. You know how much goes in. You don't have any idea what goes out. The money goes into the company, and it doesn't go out. And these plans have been based essentially on Pinochet's plan imposed at gunpoint in Chile in 1974. When the Chicago boys went down to Chile, they said, we cannot have free economics without closing down every department in the country that disagrees with this. Every economics department was closed down. Every social science department was closed down. About 10,000 labor leaders and government people were murdered or driven into exile. That was the precondition for the free market that paved the way for the Reagan-Bush administration policies of essentially having a pension plan so that the workers have their salaries docked. They're called ESOPs, Employee Stock Ownership Plans. The money is put into the company's stock, as it was for Enron and for Bear Stearns. The company then lends the money to itself, pays the executives exorbitant salaries, gives them stock options and bonuses, and then says, we're bankrupt, you're wiped out. And about half of the United States ESOP plans have gone bankrupt, and workers are end-runned. President Bush says this is the free market. This is a wonderful breakthrough. It's wealth creation because corporations are now free to keep all the money that the workers have set aside for themselves, and they can pay them out as dividends.
Right, and in the old defined benefit pension funds, you knew what you were going to be able to collect when you retired.
Yes.
But that's not the case anymore.
No, that money has been paid out in dividends and interest and executive remuneration.
Acolytes of the Chicago School claim that there's no such thing as a free lunch, but they don't mean what people usually think they mean. What do they really mean?
They say that everybody earns what they get, so that if you're an executive, let's say you're the Countrywide executive who paid himself $125 million last year while the company went bankrupt, he's provided the service of adding wealth. So they say all of the rich people, Donald Trump is worth what he gets, anybody who owns property and inherits it earns what they get, anybody who has a trust fund earns what they get, so that nothing's free. And therefore, nothing should be taxed, because if everybody earns what they get, then the government's just taking it away, and nothing should be regulated, because everything is perfectly in balance.
Now, a very important component of all of this is tax policy. Could you talk about tax policy?
The ideal of classical economics was to tax away the free lunch. In other words, they said that there are two kinds of taxes. Most people think of taxes as adding to what you, adding to cost. For instance, if you earn wages and you have to pay tax on it, then you have less to spend on consumption and investment. And the break-even price, if you're taxed, the cost of production goes up. If a company's profits are taxed, that company has to charge enough money to cover the taxes as well as its cost of production. The classicists said there's an exception to this, and that's monopoly profits and land rent. For instance, if you tax the land the rental value, you're not going to remove the land from production because nature supplies it. You're not going to reduce the supply of land if you tax it. What you'll do is collect the rent essentially for the government. And from ancient Babylonia, Greece, Rome, medieval Europe, England after the Norman invasion, almost every country for thousands of years based the tax system on the land rent. Now, the advantage of this is that the government used this rent to finance its operations and infrastructure spending and everything else, and so it didn't have to go into debt. Well, gradually, the vested interests were able to gain enough power that they began to argue that land shouldn't be taxed and monopolies shouldn't be taxed. And so the money that used to be paid as the tax base, the land rent, instead was kept by the private sector and usually put into the financial market. And that forced governments to do one of two things. Either it had to tax income or sales, excise taxes, or it had to borrow. And in effect, it began to borrow from the landlords in the financial sector, precisely the wealthy groups that it used to tax. So today, instead of the government taxing wealth under the progressive tax code that it had from 1913 until the 1970s, it now borrows from the rich and pays them interest on it. Now, untaxing property, if your real estate taxes go down, people have the idea that that's going to make their living cheaper. But it doesn't make it cheaper at all, because if taxes on a property go down, there are going to be bidders who are going to say, well, there's more rent available. I can buy that I can borrow the money from a bank and buy that property and pay the mortgage out of the rental income. And the less tax there is, the more rental income is going to be freed to pay the bankers. And that's pretty much what's happened since the 1930s. The lower the tax rate on property, the more money is freed from taxes to pay the bankers, and the result is that the homeowner or the renter has to pay exactly the same price that they'd pay for a home in any case, because home prices and commercial building prices are set by the marketplace. But instead of the rental value going to pay taxes, it goes to pay the banks. Meanwhile, the government, lacking this sort of tax revenue, has shifted away from taxing property and levied heavier and heavier sales taxes and taxes on income, so that people are paying twice for what they used to pay once for. The money that they used to pay as taxes now goes to the bank, and they still have to pay the same taxes that they did before. So the tax and debt burden has approximately doubled on most people, making the banks and the financial sector very rich, and the banks and the financial sector have used this money to become the largest political contributors in Washington, and essentially to buy senators like Mr. McCain to rewrite the tax laws in their favor and untax them more and more and shift the taxes on to workers and even on to industry.
Yes, I believe in one of our earlier shows, we did talk about real estate taxes and how when the real estate taxes go down, instead of the money going to the government, which would invest in infrastructure, et cetera, the money goes to the banks. Now, how do the banks invest the money? They invest it, they spend it differently than the government would, don't they?
Yes, they banks lend 70% of their money for mortgage credit. There's a myth in the textbooks that banks lend money to finance industry. No bank lends money to finance industry. They lend against collateral already in place. So the banks will lend against real estate in the form of mortgage loans, that's 70%. They'll make loans to corporate raiders. They'll make loans to brokerage houses to buy stocks that have already been issued. And essentially, they'll lend money to other governments and for derivatives trade and speculation. And these are all things that the government doesn't spend money on. It spends its money on doing what governments do, bombing people, military expending is the best, paying off their political constituencies, also a little bit of welfare, social security and health care, and some infrastructure spending.
Now, the banks tend then to invest their money in assets that already exist. They're not really investing in new research and development and new industry.
No, capital formation, research and development are financed almost entirely out of retained earnings by corporations. And to the extent that the banks lend money to outside raiders to take over these companies, the money that used to be spent on capital formation and long-term research and development has to be spent to pay the banks, and so the effect of bank lending is actually to crowd out direct investment spending.
What is the relationship of the stock market to industrial?
The stock market's been turned into a vehicle for borrowers to take over industry on credit and essentially strip their assets and close them down. There's been a huge flow of money out of the stock market as the stock market is available for people, for corporate raiders to borrow the money, buy out stocks on credit, and load the companies down with debt. So the stock market has become exactly the opposite of what it used to be in theory. It's not a way of raising money for investment. It's a way of stripping assets.
But now, did the stock market in the past used to function differently?
In principle, it did, but it's always been, certainly in this country, in England, it's been rife with fraud. It's always been pretty much operators. For instance, in the 1890s, you would have the biggest part of the stock market were the railway stocks. And the insiders would simply issue bonds called watered stocks to themselves and to the politicians who backed them and to their cronies. And they would then say, look at all the bond interest we have to pay. We have to raise the railway rates because we have all of these expenses. This is what led to the railroad regulations, the Interstate Commerce Commission being created, and to the Antitrust Acts being created. So basically, the stock market has always been pretty much something that raises money only after a company's already in place. So basically, it's venture capitalists who start a company with their own money, then they cash out by putting the company up for sale on the stock market, mainly to sell to pension funds, who are the main buyers. And once you have a company that has its stock going, essentially, if you're a manager of a company, then you think, if I'm only getting paid, say, $25 million a year, that's not fair. I should be paid $100 million a year. So what you do is you give yourself stock options, and you exercise your stock options to essentially give yourself free stocks, and then you have to find somebody to buy it. And the fact that the pension funds and foreigners come into the market means that you sell them to the poor hapless pension funds or to the Saudis or OPEC or whoever else is buying. And then at the end, once you've got your money out, you really don't care what's happened, and you let the stocks collapse, which is pretty much what Bear Stearns did, for instance, in its stock operations.
Well, now, what about people's pensions, those that still exist? Are they going to be there in your view?
Some will and some won't. The ones that are most in trouble are actually state and municipal pensions. These are vastly underfunded. There's simply no money to pay these. And the one source that was supposed to pay state and municipal pensions for public workers was the real estate tax. But now that property prices are falling, the banks say, wait a minute, if we have to pay taxes, then the banks will go under, and we already have negative equity, so you're not able to tax us. So one after another, it looks like the state's municipalities are going to default on their pensions. Last year, President Bush said that the Social Security is purely fictitious, that there is no Social Security fund, and for once he was telling the truth to people. He said that essentially the FICA withholding that's taken away from workers' paychecks is really just a concealed tax, and it was really just to cut taxes on the rich, and so there isn't any money to pay Social Security, so he would like to stop it right now. McCain has just come out saying that, too. So essentially, they say Social Security's broke. you're not going to get it. And most voters apparently agree with that and want to reelect the congressmen who have produced this state of affairs.
What is economic globalization really? I mean, isn't it really just an unregulated asset grab that turns over the natural wealth of individual nations to the global financial elite?
No, it's very heavily regulated. The economy is moving towards central planning by the large financial institutions that are coordinated by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So, essentially, the globalization is a centrally planned asset stripping of countries outside of the United States. Countries are to give their economic surplus to the United States as exports, and they are to serve as markets for whatever the United States can produce in excess, mainly agricultural crops and military equipment. So globalization is very, very tightly regulated.
Why do national governments around the world cooperate with corporate globalization?
There are two reasons. Either they're wittingly pro-American, or they are run by oligarchies who are making money by this process, because the essential philosophy of globalization is to strengthen oligarchies, or they're just afraid of disagreeing with the United States and passively go along with it. The assumption underlying all political theory and economic theory is that nations and individuals act in their own self-interest. And obviously, that premise of economic and political theory is not being followed. They're not acting in their self-interest. China is, a few other countries are, and the United States is, but it's as if other countries are passively going along with a strategy that is undercutting them, or at least was until Venezuela, Cuba, Brazil, and Argentina began to break away here, and China moved to create the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to make an Asian currency block.
A very pressing question at this time is the massive food and energy costs worldwide, which are causing misery and protests. Do you think speculation at the commodities future markets is the primary cause of skyrocketing prices, or is it more a matter of monetary policy, low interest rates, easy credit, and the weak dollar?
Well, neither. Well, speculation is a function of monetary policies and deregulation, so certainly speculation has played some role. But at the same time, there are many other factors that have been pushing up oil prices. The main factor is the decline in the dollar. Americans have seen oil prices go up, but they're not going up for the Europeans so much. They're not going up for countries that have hard currencies. The OPEC countries have said the oil prices are going up for two reasons. Number one, the dollar is going down and we're pricing our oil in euros. So as the dollar depreciates against the euro, you're going to have to pay more and more dollars in order to give us exactly the same price in hard currency we're getting before. Secondly, the dollar is going down because of the war in Iraq, and OPEC says we don't want to encourage you to have a thriving economy while you're attacking us all. So we're not going to support the war in Iraq. We're going to raise the price. And third, they say that as the dollar goes down, we've lost so much money on the dollar reserves that we've held in past years that we have to make it up by charging more. So essentially, this is a response to the U.S. War in Iraq and to the free ride. And that means that the prices will continue to go up until the United States cures the balance of payments, mainly by cutting back its military spending and reindustrializing the economy.
Well, you know, I had thought that the rise in oil prices, gasoline prices, for instance, for Americans, did have to do with the demise of the dollar. And yet when I saw the protests in Europe, the truckers blocking the roads because of the high fuel costs, I began to think, well, it's got a lot more to do with other elements involved other than just the demise of the dollar.
Well, it's connected to the war, as I said. The prices have gone up recently in Europe, but nowhere near as much as they've gone up for the United States. A lot of these protests have been organized for covert political reasons that I'm not sure exactly what they are, but they're more than they seem. But again, the OPEC countries are saying we want to recoup the dollars losses that we've had on our foreign exchange reserves, and Europe has not made that connection. They act as if somehow just the government can somehow stop taxing oil. It's not going to do that, and all the strikes are doing is disrupting the local economies.
Now, I believe that you have written that OPEC is cutting back on its oil production. Is that true?
There have been mixed messages. Some countries wanted to cut back. Last week, Saudi Arabia said it was going to produce more, and the other OPEC countries, Iran and Venezuela and others, said, wait a minute, if you produce more when we're saying produce less, then we're going to expel you from OPEC, at the very least. And the fact is, the producing more crude oil is not going to have any effect at all on the gasoline prices here, because there's no refinery capacity. Every refinery in the world is now operating at full capacity. There's no extra shipping capacity. Shipping rates are going way up because there's nothing to ship them in. So no matter how much more Saudi Arabia says it's going to produce, there's no means of shipping it to the U.S. or other countries, no means of refining it once it gets here. So this is all basic propaganda. The oil companies are very happy with all the situation. For them, the Cheney and Bush war in Iraq has been a win-win situation. Either if they win the war, they get to grab all the oil for themselves and kick out the Russians and Chinese that were beginning to develop the oil resources under Saddam. And if they lose the war, then there will be such a disruption in oil supply that prices will go up and create an umbrella for the American producers to make super profits. So they're very happy both ways, and they like to blame foreigners because they don't want to be blamed themselves.
So now you've implied in your writing that the oil companies have consciously and on purpose not expanded their refinery capacity or the shipping capacity. Is that true?
Yes, it's true. It's not only on purpose. Nobody wants refineries, and environmental laws in many countries prevent refineries from being built if they pollute the water and air and are unsafe. The oil companies refuse to build safe tankers. They say it costs more. They refuse to build refineries that don't pollute. They refuse to use modern technology. China, India, and other countries are the only countries that are going to be using this technology. So essentially, the oil companies have gone on strike and said, what we're going to do is create a bottleneck. We're going to blame it on the environment because you're not going to let us dump oil all over your cities. You're not going to let us pollute the air and act illegally. So it's all your fault that we have created a bottleneck between crude and the gasoline you get. Remember, the oil doesn't go from a Saudi oil well into your car. It goes from a Saudi oil well into a very expensive refining and shipping operation. And if there's a bottleneck here, you're not going to get the gasoline in your car.
Well, now, why would the U.S. oil companies be refusing to upgrade their facilities like you say they do?
Because they've been able to increase, by not upgrading their facilities, they've increased the price of oil from $20 to $140 per barrel. They've been able to make the largest profits they've ever made in history by doing it. All they have to do is not produce, and the demand goes way, way up. It's the easiest way to make money there is. It's a free lunch. And unlike Russia, America has no resource rent tax. So the companies essentially don't even have to pay a tax on the earnings.
So so these oil companies are acting out of pure greed. There's no other level of anything.
Yes.
Wow.
I should say that I was formerly the oil industry specialist in balance of payments for Chase Manhattan. I've worked for Continental Oil. I have a long background in the oil industry.
So then simply, what do you think that the price of gasoline represents? It's now at like $4.50.
The equilibrium price is $16 a gallon.
Now, what do you mean by that?
That's the price that it's moving towards and probably should be, will be within about 3 years.
Within 3 years, you think that a gallon of gasoline is going to cost $16.
If you make an equilibrium model, given the fact that the rate at which the dollar is going down, and the threatened war in Iran, if you factor in all of these, that's the number that's being used in Wall Street. If Bush attacks Iran, the price will go immediately up to $8 a gallon, and from there probably to $12 this year.
Well, then, what is the role of the U.S. dollar globally today? Will the U.S. be able to continue getting its free ride from foreign economies as the dollar tanks?
As long as the eye can see, it will. There's no way of knowing when the free ride will stop until other countries push back. And in order for the dollar not to get the free ride, that means that other countries would have to band together and create an alternative currency to the dollar. So far, they haven't done it. The euro is not really an alternative currency. It's sort of a satellite currency to the dollar. Sterling is undergoing weakness now because the economy's has its own real estate crisis going. So foreign countries essentially will have to isolate the United States and go their own way. There's no sign of that happening yet. When countries do go their own way, such as Iran, Iraq, Venezuela, the United States threatens to go to war with them.
Right. So at this moment, the rest of the world, it continues to be so tied in to the dollar and the U.S. economy that you don't see a breakaway happening immediately.
No, there's no way of forecasting when it will happen. If the United States does attack Iran, that would certainly catalyze the break.
So how do you see, let's say then that there is no break with this U.S. globalized dollar economy in the foreseeable future, in the near future, let's say. So how do you see this global economic situation progressing? How is it going to go in the near term?
A slow crash. Stocks will go down, more and more foreclosures. The real estate market is dead. Things will just continue to get slowly worse and worse and worse.
After the Fed's rescue of the financial system by arranging for the purchase of Bear Stearns, the stock market rebounded for a few months, but now it's plunging again to its lowest level since March, below 11,900. An analyst at Royal Bank of Scotland just issued a warning to his bank's clients that the S&P 500 will collapse by over 300 points to around 1,000 in the next few weeks, a plunge of close to 30%. Obviously, nerves are rattling again on Wall Street and in other financial centers. Do you see major financial instability in the near future as well?
Let's put it this way. I talk to a lot of money managers who have a lot of their own money to invest. Every single one of them has all their money in short-term treasury bonds. None of them are in the market. So everybody is afraid right now that this might happen. Again, you can never tell exactly when the break will come. On paper, the banks today are in the position they were in 1980. They have negative equity. Citibank is talking about more write-downs on its junk mortgages. Almost all of the banks have a junk mortgage problem today that more is very much like the third world debt problem they had after 1982. The question is the government going to keep letting the banks sell hundreds of billions of dollars? The government bailed out Wall Street by $1 trillion in April while claiming that there's no money to pay Social Security because that, over the next 40 years, will run up to $1 trillion. So here, the government says, we can't give labor $1 trillion in 40 years, but we're going to give our constituents on Wall Street $1 trillion just in April alone. So the government can keep just printing the money and printing the money to inflate stock and bond prices, but it's not going to give money for actual employment, actual production, or investment, that is tangible capital formation. So it's a question of how long the government can do this and how many foreigners are going to be willing to let their banks go bankrupt one by one, such as Germany's been letting its banks go bankrupt and England has been nationalizing its bankrupt banks.
So it sounds like other countries, the world is kind of stuck for the time being, and we're just going to see how fast or how slow this implodes.
That's right. There's a naive view that somehow everything is going to be different when the Democrats come into power. But the last time the Democrats were in power, they were to the right of the Republicans. Clinton basically was a right-wing Republican and did more anti-labor, pro-wealth policies than essentially the Republicans could have done, and that's basically what the Democratic Party is for. The Republicans are viewed as the anti-labor party, so if you're going to double-cross labor, if you're going to really hurt the economy, it has to be a Democrat that does it, not a Republican. And so it looks to me like Wall Street is all for the Democrats coming in, hoping that Obama will turn out to be another Clinton and will appoint Rubin, who sort of bankrupted Russia, or someone like Alan Greenspan, who Clinton reappointed.
Right. Well, it was Clinton who got NAFTA passed, not Bush, and also got through the so-called welfare reform.
Right. I'm not sure. I don't think the rumor is true that Obama is going to appoint Mark Rich as Secretary of the Treasury, but people are talking that way now that he's appointed Mr. Rubin as one of his advisors.
Now, how likely is a major depression in the United States or worldwide?
Certainly inevitable for the United States, not inevitable worldwide. All the other countries have to do is cut themselves loose from the dollar. In this country, America has no way of paying for its trade deficit and no way of paying for its military spending abroad. So if something has to give, America would prefer to impose a very deep depression than give up one penny of military spending. So I expect a very sharp increase in unemployment. People are talking that real estate prices have another 30% to fall at least, and that's only as far as the eye can see. Large-scale foreclosures, bankruptcies, while military spending will increase.
Well, I know this is probably an impossible question to answer, but how likely, do you have any feeling as to whether or not the U.S. government really would attack Iran?
There's a lot of talk of it. When you had the U.N. Specialist for Atomic Energy saying that he'll resign if America does that next week. And by America attacking Iran, that includes Israel also, because President Bush just got back from meeting with Israel, and the discussion in the press is that he was mainly discussing how Israel could act as an American proxy and attack Iran.
So I suppose that eventuality is not out of question.
Well, that's why the stock market's bad. That's why oil prices went up on Friday, because you don't need to be a speculator to force up prices. All you need to do is read the paper, and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times both said because of people's fear that America will attack Iran, that would interrupt oil supplies so much that oil prices would soar, and that is what is pushing oil up. Not speculation, the threat of America's saber-rattling about Iran.
Well, now, in the near term, we've talked about how the economic situation looks pretty bad, particularly for the United States. Assuming all of this happens assuming the future unfolds in the ways that we've been discussing, sort of a slow crash, let's say, what is the world going to look like in the next couple of years, do you think?
It's very hard to see. A lot of it depends on the military situation. It looks like there is a fragmenting of the world into regional blocks. One block will be Russia, China, and India, and other Asian countries together. One block may be the Latin American bloc. Europe will go slowly downhill. Essentially, in Washington, not only Donald Rumsfeld, but others refer to it contemptuously as old Europe. It's going to essentially be squeezed, and North America will essentially be squeezed. So it'll be a regionalization.
a regionalization. And then, of course, it's going to look very differently if the United States starts another war as opposed to just a sort of a slow economic...
Oil prices would go very high up. That would mean really such a crash of the stock, bond, and real estate markets that there would be an unprecedented economic polarization between creditors and debtors. The whole world would become a grab bag.
Exactly, and I guess it's hard to say exactly what that would look like. I mean, it could be massive homelessness, right?
It could. The United States usually is the only country that is able to land on its feet in a grab bag. So it's always willing to play that strategy. Europe always does very badly, and we don't know what the other countries will do.
Dr. Hudson, describe what you mean by the new road to serfdom. How does it differ from the old road to serfdom?
The old road to serfdom was written by essentially neo-fascist writers from the University of Chicago, saying that the road to serfdom was government protecting people to promote free markets. They said that promoting free market is a road to serfdom because of government planners. The new road to serfdom is when the financial industry knocks the government out of the picture and centralizes planning in the hands of the banks, as you've seen on Wall Street. When economic planning is centralized in the hands of Bear Stearns, Citibank, Chase Manhattan, Morgan Stanley, their objective is to get as many customers for the product they produce as possible. And the product they produce is debt. So the real road to serfdom is the road to debt peonage. And it was the same road to serfdom that Rome followed and every country that's fallen into serfdom has followed. Essentially, the wealthy people will only provide food, resources, education, essentials to people in exchange for credit, and the credit is extended up to the point where the interest charges absorb the entire economic surplus over and above basic living costs.
Now, have you just described the new road to serfdom?
Yes. In other words, the new road to serfdom is what Chicago School, Bush administration, free market policies lead to.
And what about the old road to serfdom?
That was Hayek's book, who was Margaret Thatcher's hero. He wrote it in 1944, saying any government planning, any consumer protection, any attempt to help people is going to lead to serfdom because that's fascism. And if you believe that, then you're falling for the Chicago School propaganda.
Well, it sounds like the new road to serfdom and the old road to serfdom are both pretty bad.
Not really, because the government, the fact is that progressive government planning, such as the United States had between the Civil War and World War II, wasn't bad at all. Every classical economist, every futurist writer of the 19th century expected governments to play the role of the economic planner in society. The role of government was to regulate fair markets, to create a system of equity where they would uplift the poor and enable everybody to become self-sustaining. So essentially democratic governments are not the road to serfdom. An oligarchic government and a military government is the road to serfdom, and that's what we have today, ruling under the rhetoric of free markets, which actually is not free at all.
So what you're terming the old road to serfdom then would simply be more government planning. It would be a better system.
I was referring to Hayek's book of that title that was a bestseller among the fascist class.
I see. Now, our discussion today has been pretty scary, to say the least. Do you feel, and of course we'll have to discuss this in another show, but do you feel that there's a way out for the United States if they took the proper economic steps?
Well, essentially, the path that was going on before World War I was a very good path. That was sort of the progressive era. And if you look at the first Income Tax Act, for instance, that was passed in 1913, only people who earned more than in today's money, $102,000 a year, even had to file a tax return. There was a cutoff point. If you didn't earn, in today's money, $102,000, you didn't have to pay any income tax, you didn't have to file a tax return. Capital gains were taxed the same rate as normal income, because one of the richest men in the country, Andrew Mellon, was Secretary of the Treasury in the 1920s, and he said that it was unfair to let rich people pay a lower tax rate than laborers did who had to work hard. All of this has been turned upside down today. The richer you are, the more income you make, the higher bracket you're in, the less you have to pay, the lower your tax rate. All of that can be returned to the direction the country was going prior to World War I.
But then, of course, that would depend upon politicians, elected officials, responding to the population rather than corrupt corporate interests, right?
That's true, and this doesn't usually happen except in times of severe economic crisis. And the crisis we're going into may be so severe that people will be willing to back new politicians. It may be that the Democratic Party will finally be split, and most of the Democratic politicians will join the Republicans where they belong, and a new party will essentially come out. I don't see much of a recovery until that occurs, because the two parties are so similar right now.
So there is hope, but not a whole lot, huh?
That's right. People would have to act in their self-interest, and that's never happened.
You mean in terms of a mass political movement, something like that?
Yes, economic and political self-interest.
Dr. Hudson, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bonnie.
That was Dr. Michael Hudson, interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter from KPFA Radio, gunsandbutter.net. Michael Hudson is a financial economist and economic historian, president of the Center for Long-Term Economic Trends, a Wall Street financial analyst, and distinguished professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He has a website, michael-hudson.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Our next offering comes to us courtesy of Alex Smith at Radio EcoShock in Vancouver. He interviewed Dmitry Orlov, whose article, Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century, I read on the program a couple of years ago. Orlov has now written a book, Reinventing Collapse. Here's Alex Smith.
Is America headed towards bankruptcy, the collapse of a worldwide empire? How would you survive if gas or oil get way too expensive or sometimes not available at all? Maybe we could learn something from the fallen Soviet Union, where people had to remake a new society. Today we are joined by a former Russian who witnessed the Soviet collapse. He is an engineer who has worked on high energy physics and things like internet security. Now Dmitry Orlov has written a really useful book about civilizations in trouble. Welcome, Dmitry.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, of course, we're going to talk about your new book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. But first, I'd like to plunge right into something else you've written with your advice for the next American government. I mean, we're $9 trillion in debt the day the new president takes office, at least. We heard some unreal promises from Obama and McCain. Can you tell us about your collapse party platform?
Well, it's basically a mock political party, because no government ever actually explicitly prepares for collapse. They do everything they can to avert or postpone it, and sometimes those efforts bring the collapse closer than instead of helping defer it. But I identified a few things that I thought would be worth doing, just basically in an effort to prevent disasters that are avoidable